Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we have the fabulously named Turtle Bunbury discussing what it was like in the world in 1847.
Good evening to you all. Good evening, Chalk Valley. It is a delight to be here, I must say. We all of us have years that come up time and again, quite a lot of them connected to battles, 1066, 1415, 1815, and so on. For me, it has been this year, the one here, 1847, which has chased me around since I was a young fella. And that's what I'm going to tell you about a little bit over the course of this evening. It's a great year. It's a really interesting year. I hope you agree. It first occurred to me when I was at school. I was at school in Scotland in a place called Glenarmond, which was established in 1847. Don't mind that. It was a coincidence. I did notice that my house was also built in 1847, the home where I live in Ireland. So I had the two connected at that point. And then we had to study Wuthering Heights when we were kids. And I loved the book, because who couldn't? I loved the Irish connection. Do you know the Irish connection? That their father, the Bronte sisters, their father, Patrick Bronte, was an Irishman from County Down. The family used to be called Brunty, but he thought that wasn't classy enough, and he changed the name from Brunty to Bronte after the Duke of Bronte, who is known to you and I as Admiral Nelson. Anyway, I loved the Irish connection, and I couldn't help but notice you can't see it here, but that says 1847. So, oh, she published that book in the same year. And not only was she, but her sisters were having an extremely busy year, or brothers as they were initially. You'll see Acton Bell, Currer Bell, and Ellis Bell, who were, of course, revealed later to be the Bronte sisters, Charlotte, Emily, and Anne, writing Wuthering Heights, Agnes Grey, and Jane Eyre, all published in 1847. I thought, wow, that's interesting. They, of course, would all have rather sad demises within 7 years. So tragic. I mentioned the house that I grew up in Ireland. As you can see, it's not a bungalow. It is quite a sizable house, which was built by a very brilliant, eccentric architect who'd grown up in Charleston in South America, of all places, and for various reasons had ended up coming back to Ireland. Coming back to England first, and then he went bankrupt in England. And in those days, if you were bankrupt in England, you went to Ireland. Plus ça change. He built the house. He was famous. He built a number of houses around Ireland, all of that sort of Tudor Gothic style, and was famous for being wheeled around in a wheelbarrow while drinking from a bottle of sherry and giving his instructions. So that might explain some of the dimensions on the house. He also turned up. You see, we have an archive of letters from that time from him to Captain Bunbury, my forebear, in which he talks about all the different processes of building the house. And it was a massive enterprise. There was 130 people employed over the course of 2 years. But one of without a doubt, my favorite is when he bought his daughter's parakeet down because his wife was feeling unwell, and she said, "Get that bloody bird out of my house." And so he brought a parakeet to the building site, and then he went off to do his things. And he wrote to Captain Bunbury, "I was elated upon my return to find a herd of your bullocks surrounding the birdcage to enjoy the infernal screamings of my saucy bird, who cared not for a dozen pair of horns within a yard of his habitation." On the walls of my house are, he's the family hero, Leopold McClintock. And he had a pretty interesting 1847 too. Well, let me backtrack. In 1847, you may know about the Franklin expedition up to the Arctic, when these two ships, Erebus and Terror, had set sail. They actually set sail in 1845 or early 1846 to try and find the Northwest Passage to break through into that link through to possibly to China and so on. It was the most cutting-edge mission of its day. Michael Palin has just written about it all. But unfortunately, the ships got trapped in ice, and they were stuck, and nobody back in these parts knew what had happened to them. And it took a very long time to find out what happened to them. But Leopold McClintock, our family hero, was sent off. He went to a place called King William's Island up there, where he journeyed on a series of winter sledges, and they were drawn by men and dogs in this ingenious kite system. He's known as the father of modern sledging. There you go. There's a father for everything these days. The father of modern sledging. Anyway, what he discovered was in a pile of rocks on this island, they found this letter scrolled up. Well, it was a naval instructions, but around the side, I know you probably can't read it, but this is handwriting explaining what had happened to Franklin and his 128 men. Quite a lot of them were dead already, including Sir John Franklin, who had died on June the 24th, I think, 1847. So you see this link coming back to me again. But very, very tragic. When I published my book on the subject, within about 2 months, my book, even though it was about events that had taken place 170-something years earlier, it was out of date because they discovered terror. They'd already discovered Erebus a few years earlier, but they've discovered terror up in the Arctic now. In a place called, in the Inuit language, people have been hunting for it for 170 years, McClintock included. And in the Inuit language, the bay and where they found it translates as the bay where the ship is. They slightly missed that one. Okay. Can't, in these parts, Wessex as was, Dorset, is their heroine, of course, Mary Anning, who you'll be hearing quite a lot about, I think, because there's a film coming out with Kate Winslet and Saoirse Ronan from Ireland, all about Mary Anning. I think it's called Ammonite. For those who don't know her, she was the most famous fossil hunter of her age in the 1820s, 1830s, pushing into the 1840s. And she would go down the coast there near Lyme Regis in Dorset and unpluck all sorts of ammonite and belemnite shells initially. Dinosaur poo was a huge seller because lots of people would go to Lyme Regis then as now. When she was little, she and her brother had little stalls set out in which they'd sell, as I say, corpulite, otherwise known as dinosaur poo, and other things to the visitors. Then, after storms especially, you would go down along that cliff face and see what had turned up after all that coastal erosion had taken place. And her brother found the skeleton of an ichthyosaur, as it's called, and she found the head. And this was breakthrough stuff. Nobody knew what these creatures were. They thought it was a fish lizard, a dragon. The word dinosaur had only just, well, no, it hadn't been invented when they found it. So she pioneered it, and she didn't just stop at sticking them out for tourists to buy. She researched and wrote very learned articles, and her explanations as to how things might have come about were hugely valued by the same geologists who then swindled her. And it was a man's world, I'm afraid, and she got swindled and shafted endlessly by people. She had some very loyal men friends, and then there were some people who were unprintably bad. And I'm afraid that's what drove her in the year 1847. One of the reasons, my sister's always been a huge fan of this lady. She collects fossils and mosses and things. In 1847, she was addicted to something called Godfrey's cocktail, which is a syrupy cocktail of caraway seeds, treacle, brandy, and opium. And that's what was her tipple of choice, otherwise known as Mother's Little Helper, because apparently in those days, a couple of little shots never failed to induce a little slumber in your little diddums, baby. Anyway, poor Mary Anning. So she passed away in 1847, aged 47. She is, I think, more and more valued. In 2010, the Royal Society declared her one of the top 10 British women who've done the most to influence the history of science. And as I say, I imagine the movie will bring her to light a little bit more. My sister likes mosses. My daughters love donuts. And this is the only chapter in my book that they'll ever read. But Hanson Gregory, who was a sailor from Rockport, Maine, if anybody knows that part of the world, the story is that when he's a young man, he's at sea and he's going through a storm and he's got this sort of Dutch oil cake. It's a sort of oily fried cake, and he doesn't know what to do with it, and he rams it on the spoke of his steering wheel, and then says, ingenious, and, you know, rides out the storm, and then goes back to Chef and says, can you do that again? That is allegedly the birth of the donut in a storm in 1847. It has prompted, the picture there is actually been doctored, apparently, ahead of the great donut debate of 1941, which some of you may have attended, who knows. Okay. My daughters like donuts. My wife likes diamonds. This isn't, sadly, one of hers. It is a sapphire and diamond ring from Cartier, which is another 1847 special. Louis-François Cartier, whose father was in Napoleon's Imperial Infantry during the Napoleonic Wars, and was very nearly executed until a friendly baker's wife threw him into an oven, and somehow or other he managed to escape. Anyway, his son became a jeweler, a goldsmith in Paris, and actually registered his trademark in 1847, just in time, because the following year, as you may know, the 1848 revolutions kicked off all across Europe. And the upshot of it was that in France, you ended up with Napoleon Bonaparte's 40-year-old nephew, called Louis Napoleon Bonaparte, becoming the president of the Second Republic of France. And what does one of the first things he says? He says, Paris, it must become the center of the world's diamond industry. So Louis-François Cartier is going, yes! Chose the right spot for that, and the rest, as you know. Once you start, 1847 is everywhere, even in Broadchalk. The church has been here for 1,000 years plus, as far as I can work out. It's built in the 15th, 17th century, but the roof was re-roofed in the year of our Lord, 1847, by an Irishman, incidentally, Thomas Wyatt from Roscommon, working with a Scot called David Brandon, and they opened with a discreet celebration in May 1847. You're getting the gist of where I'm coming from. As a student, I was picking up cans of Carlsberg, going, it's chasing me. Student drink. Jacob's Creek, another student drink. Also, Dipwee, 1847, the Australian wine. I'm going everywhere I go. After college, I went to Hong Kong, and I lived there for a few years, and I became a travel writer. And I was always keeping one eye out for the stories. And Da Nang in Vietnam is a very good example of one, because while I was there, I learned about this extraordinary moment when the French bombarded Da Nang in 1847. So I had to go and figure out what that story was about. The French had been knocking around Vietnam since the 1780s, and they'd installed the monarchy of Vietnam. They'd backed it, and it had got the throne, and they were the emperors of Vietnam. But a couple of generations later, the emperor, who was called Tu Tri, sounds a little like an Irishman adding up, Tu Tri, he had been in power for 7 years by the year 1847. During that time, he didn't like French people. He didn't like what they were trying to do. He knew that they were trying to come into his kingdom. He wanted a sort of hermit kingdom. Also, perverse Catholic missionaries spreading this nonsense about this guy from Galilee amongst his people, and with quite successful. A lot of Christian converts in Vietnam at that time. So he had started sort of kicking them out. He wasn't killing anybody or executing. The French said, mm-mm, and they sent in a couple of warships into Da Nang, or Touraine, as it used to be called. And in April 1847, they woke up one morning and said, let's do it. And they went, and they blew up Da Nang. They annihilated the entire port, killed 1,200 people, and sank most of the emperor's ships that were in the neighborhood, and then legged it, which is probably the right thing to do from their perspective. And that, without... You know, that does provide the pretext for the French invasion of Southeast Asia, for the establishment of French Indochine. It begins, to my mind, in 1847. And bad day for poor old Emperor Tu Tri, who is only 40, and the following November, he's dead. he dies in possibly a smallpox epidemic or possibly murdered, don't know. He leaves 64 daughters and sons, so a lot of people to look after on that front. But anyway, the dynasty ruled on, for those who follow the Vietnam story, to Bao Dai, who was the last emperor of Vietnam, when he abdicated and transferred power to the People's Democratic Republic of Vietnam in 1945. So, Vietnam, 1847. The moment when I knew that I had to write this book, I'm walking around Mexico City, randomly, in a suburb called San Angel, and I just go for a stroll with a hangover, I might add, and I see a memorial, and I go up and stand in front of it, and it says, "A memoria de los soldados irlandeses." I'm irlandeses? That's Irish. Del Heroica Battalion San Patricio, the St. Patrick's Battalion, executed in 1847. Captain John O'Reilly, otherwise known as Juan Riley, his deputy, Santiago O'Leary. I'm like, who are these people? It's an extraordinary story, but basically, in the tail end of 1846, or sorry, in the middle of 1846, the Americans invaded Mexico, something that is still having its repercussions right to this very moment. It was kind of revenge for the Alamo, which had taken place 10 years earlier, all that Davy Crockett stuff, but it was also to fulfill the manifest destiny of Americans to go coast to coast, and to do that, they had to knock Mexico out of the contest, because Mexico owned California, for starters, Alta California, as it was. So they engineered an excuse for an invasion, and the Americans went down, and it was a mass. It was their first ever invasion of a foreign country, the United States, under James Polk, who was a 49-year-old, newly elected Democrat, but a warmonger, no doubt. They head down, and they take on the Mexicans in a series of, there were seven major battles, and Mexico lost every one of them. But the San Patricios were kind of an elite battalion who fought in the Mexican army. Quite a lot of them, most of them, were deserters from the American army who had transferred their allegiance to the Mexicans for various reasons, because their sympathies with the Catholic country, because the Mexicans paid more money, and various other reasons. And it wasn't just Irish. They were Catholics from Germany and France and Spain and freed slaves from the north of America as well. But if Mexico won, they were on to a good thing. But as you can... anyway, it wasn't happening. Mexico got annihilated. 25,000 Mexicans killed during the war, 13,000 Americans, most of whom lost their lives from disease. This, you will see here, is the Battle of Buena Vista. And it's just an exchange of letters from the opposing generals. The Mexican general was Santa Anna, who had been in charge of the Alamo when they massacred the garrison in the Alamo. And he was 11 times president of Mexico, so a virtual dictator at various times in his career. His men outnumber the Americans 4 or 5 to 1. They're all surrounded, and he sends a guy down to Zachary Taylor, who's the American general. And it says to Zachary, "Sir, you are surrounded by 20,000 men. You cannot, in any human probability, avoid suffering a rout and being cut to pieces with your troops. But as you deserve consideration and particular esteem, I wish to save you from a catastrophe. And for that purpose, I give you this notice in order that you may surrender at discretion under the assurance that you will be treated with the consideration belonging to the Mexican character. With this view, God and liberty, Antonio Lopez de Santa Anna." Taylor didn't keep the messenger waiting long. He said, "Sir, in reply to your note of this date summoning me to surrender my forces at discretion, I beg leave to say that I decline acceding to your request. With high respect, I am, sir, your obedient servant, Zed Taylor." And needless to say, he won. They annihilated the opposition. By the end of the year, the Americans were in Mexico City. And they forced a pretty major treaty on the Mexican government, by which the United States grew massively. Hopefully you know enough about where I'm talking about, but they seize Texas, becomes uncontested. They get California, New Mexico, large chunks of Wyoming, Arizona, Utah, Nevada, Colorado. So a massive amount of the United States they gather. They expanded by over a third, and they get coast to coast. That's what they wanted. The San Patricios are rounded up, arrested those who are still alive, and because they've deserted from the American army, they are traitors, which is why they were all executed on the spot that I found myself standing in San Angel. So, slightly grim story. Santa Anna, he somehow or other retires to Staten Island, New York, of all places, and he tries his luck at bringing in something called chicle, which is he's hoping that it's going to be an alternative to rubber for the tire industry, which is starting to take off. It didn't pan out, but his secretary ends up bringing some of the chicle, which is a natural gum, to Thomas Adams, who pops some in his mouth, adds a bit of flavoring, and invents chewing gum. So there you go. Another, you can blame him for all the horrible chewing gum around our world. Meanwhile, actually on this day, the 27th of June, 1844, a terrible thing happened to the Mormon Church, or the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints, when their head man, the prophet Joseph Smith, and his brother were murdered by a mob in New York in 1844, this is. And it prompted, 3 years later, this epic trek by the Mormon pioneers who headed from a city in Illinois called Nauvoo across, all the way across America to the Salt Lake Valley, which was this expansive but empty valley where they settled, and that's obviously very much associated with the Mormons to this day. By Christmas 1847, I think they set off in May, if my memory serves, by Christmas over 2,000 of them had completed this journey to the safety of the Salt Lake Valley. And this is taken, it's the Pioneer Jubilee in 1897. And the reason why there's so many people there is because of those Mormons who made the journey, those first 2,000, over half of them were under 19, and a quarter of them were under 8. So very hardy, strong people, the Mormons, without a doubt. You have to spare a thought for Brother Clayton, William Clayton, who was a Mormon from Lancashire, whose job on this trip he had been assigned. He was 33 years old. He'd been entrusted with the mind-numbing task of recording the distance that they traveled every day. And the only way to gauge that is to count the revolutions of the wagon's wheel and then multiply that by the figure at day's end. And I think a wheel does something like 360 turns in a mile. That's fine for, you know, half an hour, but within 3 weeks of his departure, his brain was starting to melt. Necessity, invention, all that. He invents the roadometer, which now is the odometer. It's what you have in your cars, in the front of your car, that tells you how many miles or kilometers that you've done. So you can thank Brother Clayton for that invention. The government, who didn't like the Mormons, the U.S. government, didn't like them, but because they were at war with the Mexicans, they needed some all the men they could get. And I guess when they heard about these very hardy types who were able to just march across America, they offered assistance in various forms to get Salt Lake City up and running in return for a battalion of 500 Mormons who sign up to help the American army. The Mormon Battalion, which is the only religious unit ever mobilized as part of the U.S. Army, they set off on another, I think it's the longest, it is the longest march in U.S. history, the longest military march, 2,000 miles all the way from Salt Lake through to Los Angeles, where they raised the American flag in Los Angeles on the 4th of July, 1847, which is an amazing, amazing trek. One of them, Azariah Smith, is also credited with introducing baseball to California in 1847. So there you go. Colourful characters among them, Sam Brannan, who is an Irishman, who had signed up to the Mormons in New York. And he got sent on quite an exciting mission. He was to go and found, after they were having such a horrible time in New York, and Prophet Smith had been murdered and so forth, they were looking at the options. So one option was to go overland and find the Salt Lake Valley. Another was to maybe set up a Mormon kingdom, if they could work it out, with the Mexicans. So Brannan and a whole shipload of fellow Mormons head all the way down around the Americas and all the way up to California, Mexican California, where they're going to found a new Mormon kingdom. And all goes well until they arrive in Mexican California and see the stars and stripes fluttering because it's just been conquered by the United States. Anyway, he doesn't... He says, right, well, can't beat them, join them. Let's try this way. He very quickly establishes the California Star, the first newspaper in San Francisco. The first newspaper in California. And that's the newspaper that breaks the news of the discovery of gold the following year, which leads to the great 49 gold rush. In fact, when they discover gold, Brannan is running up and down the streets shouting about the discovery of gold himself. He's switched on. He's got three stores, massive sort of Waitrose equivalents, on the way to the gold fields. He cashes in on that. He becomes the first millionaire in California and the biggest landowner in Sacramento. His after story is worth following because he led an extraordinary mission of 24 adventurers to Hawaii. In fact, he'd passed through Hawaii on his way to California. But anyway, he obviously liked it. And he went back, and their mission was to depose the king, and he wanted to become king of the Hawaiian Islands. That was his plan. It didn't pan out. Anyway, he did manage to purchase 2,000 acres of the Napa Valley, where he built the Calistoga Hot Springs Hotel, complete with mud baths, a spa, Japanese gardens, a racing track, stables for 80 horses, all going swimmingly, but unfortunately, divorces, railways, and the inevitable drink got the better of him, and he was ruined. And by the last year of his life, he was selling pencils door-to-door in Arizona, poor fella. That's the discovery of gold, which would obviously change everything in those parts of the world. Yerba Buena is what it was known as on the 30th of January in 1847, just before the Americans arrived and changed the name to San Francisco. And to give you an idea, its population in 1846 was 200 people, and by 1852, it was 36,000. So that's kind of a bit of an increase. I'm not going to stay on Mormons all evening, but Brigham Young, the gentleman at the center, is worth a remark because he put in a strong challenge to Emperor Tutri. With his 68 children, Brigham Young came in with, what did he weigh in with? He had 56 children. He only had 56, but he had 55 wives, and I think he beats Emperor Tutri on that front. Impressive performance. My next character, Sir Richard Burton, actually went to visit Brigham Young, because he'd obviously love to talk to somebody who knows how to play with 55 wives. If you know Richard Burton, I'll explain him in a moment, but... He acknowledged Brigham Young in the preface to a book he wrote called The Perfumed Garden, which is a 15th century Arabic sex manual, and in which he noted Young's belief that eating large quantities of eggs reduces impotence. And you have to say that Brigham Young must have, he was a reasonably good authority on the subject. I would love to talk about Richard Burton all evening because he's such a fascinating character. Hopefully you know some of his backstory. He was one of the most remarkable explorers and spies of his generation, of any generation, really. Such a colorful character. He had Irish roots, which is why I've always been fascinated by his story. He also is a sort of blueprint for Flashman, if anybody knows the Flashman novels. A terrific linguist, for instance. He could speak 25 languages and loads of dialects. Loved women. And he had a brilliant 1847. I couldn't believe it when I was trying to think who I'm going to put in the book. I said, well, what was Burton up to? Whoosh, what was he up to? So, he'd been kicked out of Oxford for going horse racing at the wrong moment. he actually turned up to London, where his father said, "What are you doing back so early?" He said, "They let me go early because I did so well in my exams, Papa." And he said, "Brilliant, we'll throw a dinner party." And they had a huge party during which the truth was revealed and many unpleasantries exchanged. And the father then said, "Right, India," with him, and sent him off to India to join a regiment out there. And he, because he was so good at languages, he suddenly ended up catching the attention of the authorities there. And he is recruited by Charles Napier, who's the governor of Bombay, to go undercover. And he has to go basically investigating a brothel in Karachi, where the British army officers are the clients and eunuchs are the prostitutes. And this is most unacceptable to the British army then as it is now. So he was sent under as Mizrar Abdullah Shire and stained himself with henna and went undercover and had an extraordinary time doing all that. I haven't got time to go in it. He, towards the tail end, he was taken ill with cholera and he went to recover in a sanatorium near Goa. While he was there, actually, he chanced upon a nun there was a convent just beside, a pretty white girl with large black eyes, a modest smile, and a darling of a figure. So he attempted to elope with her, but that came a cropper when he abducted the wrong nun, and he talks about all this. Anyway, then his cover is blown. The report has gone to Charles Napier, the governor, but Napier has just resigned, brilliantly declaring his superiors to be a galaxy of donkeys. I think that expression should be reinvigorated. The trouble is that Burton's report is now lying on the desk of Napier's successor, and the report names quite a lot of the successor's friends, so he's slightly in a tricky position. He goes slightly on the run, but on his way, he falls in love with a beautiful Persian woman of high descent, as he called it, who he first espied resting beside a camel train outside Karachi. This is what he has to say. "She had features carved in marble like a Greek's, the noble, thoughtful Italian brow, eyes deep and lustrous as an Andalusian's, and the airy, graceful kind of figure with which Muhammad, according to our poets, peopled his man's paradise." He was head over heels in love with this lady. Unfortunately, he learned that she was ill, and he sent her something called the Elixir of Life. He called it the Elixir of Life. It was a cocktail of gin, white sugar, and eau de cologne, and not dissimilar to what Mary Anning was drinking, Godfrey's syrup, or whatever it was called. And a similar effect, I'm afraid. I don't know if that's what killed the poor woman. There was various stories that she'd been murdered by her own people for hanging out with Burton. He was devastated and wrote some very sad poems. He was clearly really genuinely in love with her. Burton being Burton, he found solace in his own way. He went to a market and he bought 40 monkeys. He found them in a bazaar in Sindh. And he named them the doctor, the chaplain, his secretary, his aide-de-camp, his wife. One of them was his wife. And he learned how to imitate their language and sounds so well that apparently he was able to converse with some of them. Not only that, this is all in 1847. You can imagine my excitement when I was reading all this, going, what? He decoded enough of their vocabulary to produce a Simian dictionary, the world's first Simian dictionary, 60 words before he called it quits, but unfortunately the dictionary was burnt along with quite a lot of his works when Grindley's warehouse in London caught fire in 1861, so we'll have to start from scratch, although I think people have actually made some good work in understanding what monkeys are saying and conversing with them. He was a pioneer. If there's anybody that Sir Richard Burton should have slept with, it's Lola Montez. Donna Lola Montez, who was the most famous, arguably the most notorious woman in Europe in 1847. She was this Spanish flamenco dancer who had hypnotized the king of Bavaria. And during the course of this sort of downfall of the king of Bavaria, it was revealed that Lola Montez was, in fact, Rosanna Gilbert from County Sligo in Ireland. She denied it emphatically, needless to say. She was born in Sligo in 1821. Her father was actually a British soldier who was stationed in Ireland. Her mother was a milliner from County Cork. And when she was a baby, actually, her father was sent out to India. And maybe some of you were at the talk earlier. We were talking about British India. Anyway, they end up going out to British India in 1822 or 3. And unfortunately, the father dies immediately from cholera. So mum marries again. And one way or the other, Lola's pretty tricky. Rosanna, I'll call her Lola, is quite tricky. So they send her back, like so many people did. And she's to go to a place called Montrose in Scotland, where she's to be raised by very dour Presbyterian relatives. And they have a pretty hard time. She runs around the town naked, and in church she pulls wigs off people's heads. And she's a troublemaker from early on. I mean, she's sent off to various schools. For instance, her art teacher, J.G. Grant, school report said, "It is impossible to look at her for many minutes without feeling convinced that she is made up of very wayward elements." So she's sent off to various things, including a boarding academy in Bath, a finishing school, which is where she learned how to dance and where she learned how to finish off men. Her first victim was a guy from my home county, County Carlow in Ireland, Thomas James, who was her mother's boyfriend. So that's where we're off to at this stage. Anyway, she goes to India with him, and it's quite complicated. Eventually, she's caught with another man on a boat, and it ends up being a big divorce trial in London. She is known as Mrs. James at this time. And so she says, "I'm going to go and reinvent myself." She goes off to Scotland, has a think, comes back to London, and introduces herself as Donna Lola Montez, and dances. And you can read the reports in the Times at the time. They're quite complimentary about her dancing. And she was doing quite well until somebody went, "That's Mrs. James, that is." And her cover was blown, a bit like Richard Burton. So she legged it to Europe, where she basically had a pretty interesting time. One of her dances, which you'll be relieved to know I'm not going to perform this evening, is a tarantula dance, where, as far as I can work out, you have to actually imagine a tarantula has landed on you, and you dance, and then you remove items of clothing in order to identify where the tarantula might be. And it was clearly a very effective dance, and she ended up having romances with all sorts of people. One early fan was Tsar Nicholas of Russia. If you're squeamish, you may need to turn away in a moment. This was a gift from Tsar Nicholas, incidentally, to the Queen in 1847, a portrait of him that's about that size. The Queen might not have known where to look, because it was clearly quite something, but it has certainly inspired, I feel, later book covers in later life. Anyway, he was a bit of a fan of Lola, but nothing happened. But that was the sort of track she was on. Franz Liszt, on the other hand, she heard that he was in Dresden, the brilliant virtuoso, who was one of the most famous and desired men of his generation. All the women loved him. She heard he was around, and she basically found his hotel in Dresden and booked the room next to it, and within 48 hours, she was home and dry, as you would say. They only stayed together for a week, at the end of which he described her as the most perfect, the most enchanting creature I've ever known, continually new, constantly changing, constantly creative, all other women pale beside her. So that's a nice thing on her CV. She became great friends with Dumas. I think they literally were just good buddies. It's quite extraordinary to see his picture. He's got an amazing story. He just published The Three Musketeers at the time. I'm not going to go there. She then headed to Munich for the Oktoberfest, because why wouldn't you? This was the Bavarian capital, and it was to become her home for the next 16 months, largely because she was so successful with this chap, 60-year-old King Ludwig, who'd had a pretty trouble-free reign for 30 years or something at this stage, and had a very loyal wife and everything. He was a little bit depressed, because he had been a bit of a Lothario when he was young. Anyway, he had this, I spoke in this place, the Schloss Nymphenburg in Munich, where he had something called the Gallery of Beauties, which is quite something. But if you're king, I suppose one of the options open to you is to get your court painter to paint 36 massive portraits of 36 beautiful women and stick them in a room, which is what he did. And actually, funnily enough, the portrait you saw earlier of Lola was one of them. He also did Jane Digby. She's from these parts, right? She was the only other English lady who was in his Gallery of Beauties. Anyway, he becomes hooked, line and sinker, on Lola fairly early on, and she's his mistress. And it causes consternation in Bavaria across. The country's run by Jesuits, by and large, the Ultramontanes. They're like, what is this hussy doing to our king? To the extent that they get a cardinal, one of the most influential men in Bavaria, writes to Ludwig. He says, King Ludwig, a poisonous tree grows above you, whose perfume numbs you, robs your eyes of vision, intoxicates your senses, and wholly beguiles you, so that you do not see the chasm before you, the open chasm that threatens to swallow up your honor, your reputation, the happiness of your family, of your land, of your life, as well as the salvation of your soul. King Ludwig, awake from your dream. Ludwig slept on. He showered her with goodies galore, houses. He made her a countess, jewelry, masses of jewelry. Eventually, it ends up in student riots, masses. 15,000 students riot. And his top 2,000 most affluent citizens all come and make a protest to him. And it's getting violent. And he realizes, do you know what? If I don't, you know, get her out of here, there's trouble. He gets her out of here, and he abdicates immediately afterwards. So she has now brought down the king of Bavaria, Lola, and his son, Crown Prince Maximilian, takes over. She moves to London. She marries again. She fetches up on the wrong side of a bigamy trial. She has to reinvent herself, goes to Spain, gets a third husband, and goes to America, goes over there. She's up and down the coast of America, dancing, by and large. She ends up in Grass Valley in California, where the gold has just been discovered, and she's running one of the saloons there, and she's also dancing and so on. They love her in Nevada County, California. They've named the highest point Mount Lola in her honor. Ironic name there. Prominent in her later life, in her last few years, she became a prominent public speaker, championing, by and large, fallen women, prostitutes and single mothers, as they were known in those days. But she caught pneumonia and died in New York in 1861 at the ripe old age of 39. So, whew, busy, busy life. How are we doing? Oh, gosh, we're galloping. There's so many tales to try and tell. You know Mendelssohn, The Wedding March. Da, 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 da. Anyway, I'm not going to do my Mr. Bean moment. poor Mendelssohn, I feel very sorry for him, to be honest, because he has such a promising 1847 when it starts. Felix Mendelssohn, the composer, his grandfather, Moses Mendelssohn, a famous philosopher, and he's a boy genius. He composed dozens of string symphonies before he was 14 years old. People who are old would compare him to Mozart, who had known Mozart, would compare him to Mozart. Comes over to London and he becomes Queen Victoria's favorite composer very quickly. She's completely smitten with him. She starts singing hymns to him and inviting him to come and walk and look at the nursery and so forth. And anytime there's a Mendelssohn performance, she and Albert are there in the front row. Hello. They love Mendelssohn. Unfortunately, then, a couple of weeks after he's in the nursery, everything goes horribly wrong. His sister, Fanny Mendelssohn, also a brilliant composer, dies of a cerebral hemorrhage suddenly one afternoon. And he's so shook that he goes into tremendous shock and writes some very, very haunting work at that time. So that's part of the problem. He's also fallen in love with his protege, Jenny Lind, who had this sort of Greek curse of people kept on falling in love with poor Jenny Lind. Hans Christian Andersen, for instance, fell in love with her, called her the Swedish Nightingale. And then when she rejected him, sort of wrote fairy tales about ladies with icy hearts that forms the basis of Frozen, which your children or grandchildren would know. Anyway, he was in love with her. He was writing music for her. And she, I think, had an enormous soft spot for him. But unfortunately, at the age of 38, it's game over for him in 1847 in Leipzig, where he dies. I haven't quite worked out what he actually died of, but the dramatic account is that a marching band, he's in a dark room, and he's been unconscious for a few days, and a marching band go past, and the story is that he opened his eyes and threw out his hands, and then closed them again. Maybe. I mean, it would be fantastic if that's true. I hope it is. Okay. More extraordinary people doing the rounds in 1847. P.T. Barnum. In fact, if you've seen The Greatest Showman, has anybody seen The Greatest Showman? And it has a whole scene about Jenny Lind in it. The scene in it has P.T. Barnum looking adoringly at Jenny Lind in the film as she breaks into song, which is actually based on Mendelssohn looking at Jenny Lind. P.T. Barnum, the greatest showman of his generation, had teamed up with his cousin, believe it or not, General Tom Thumb, as he was rebranded or renamed. And initially, when I saw this, I thought this is going to be an awful story of exploitation and so forth. But actually, they were terrific buddies all the way through their respective lives. When Barnum ran into trouble later on, Tom Thumb, he went out of his way to raise money to get him back on track, and vice versa. They looked after each other very well and are buried near each other. Tom Thumb, 2-foot-tall genius from Connecticut, they come over on tour of England, 1846, 1847. And it's a bit of a disaster initially. Everybody's like, this is a freak show. You know, what is going on here? But somehow or other, Barnum's able to persuade to get an audience with Queen Victoria. They turn up, and it doesn't really go very well. He's always dressed very immaculately, tailor-made clothes or whatever. Victoria's kind of so-so on it. And so they take their leave. And when you take your leave of your majesty in Queen Victoria's time, you're supposed to, you know, not have your back to her. You go away like this. Which is fine, Barnum was doing that, but Tom Thumb, his robes kept on getting tangled, so he was struggling and then trying to put them back over him. And Queen Victoria's spaniel was going, what's going on there? And getting more and more excited, and eventually barking, and then galloping towards General Tom Thumb, who whips out his sword that he has and starts fencing with the dog. And suddenly, Queen Victoria is amused, and she's roaring with laughter, and says, come back again. And so they do. They get a second audience with Queen Victoria, and suddenly they've got the royal seal of approval. And over the course of that time, before they eventually got on a boat back to America, he played before 5 million people, which is far more than Dickens or Jenny Lind or any of other contemporary celebrities. I would also, this is my timing, I have to be careful, but on the journey back, there was a subscription going on for another massive event that took place in 1847, which was the Great Famine in Ireland, because that was one of the key events. How am I doing on time? I think I've got... I know some of you may have questions, but I'm going to tell you this first, I'm afraid, because it's such an important part. The famine. Okay, we'll have to skip through Frederick Douglass. He's doing tours. He's all around, if you know the story of Frederick Douglass. Extraordinary life. He became great buddies with Daniel O'Connell, who was the liberator, the man who had overseen the emancipation of Catholics, particularly in Ireland, but knock-on effects all across the British Empire, really, who, you will note, died in 1847. In Rome, actually, on his way to try and meet the Pope. He, shortly before one of his last speeches, before he left Ireland, he was saying, look, you've got to sort out that we are on the precipice of a terrible catastrophe here that I think is going to kill a quarter of the Irish population. He wasn't far wrong. He was buried in Ireland. Black 47, as it is known in Ireland. And I know this is a slightly glum topic, but it's extraordinary. I've interviewed quite a lot of people in their 80s, 90s, 100s, who their grandparents were children, if not teenagers, during the time of the famine, and the oral legacy lives on, very important in Ireland. Some people call it the Great Starvation or the Great Hunger. And we're still getting to grips with it, you know, 172 years later. In 1847, as an example, nearly 400,000 men, women, and children from Ireland died of starvation or fever. Cholera was the main culprit, and another 250,000 fled, primarily to Canada and to the UK, and then going into the United States. To give you an approximate insight, Toronto in Canada, January 1847, the population 20,000. By the end of the year, it's trebled to 60,000. And you know, you can imagine where most of those newcomers have come from: Ireland. And it's very shocking and heartbreaking, and so many things. What I was trying to focus on in the book is the more uplifting stories, because there are amazing stories of people who did what they could to try and help out. The Choctaw Indians of Oklahoma had a money-raising collection to try and help the people in Ireland, which is an extraordinary event that I loved researching. It's all to do with the Trail of Tears, if you know that. But we now have an enormous bond, unexpectedly, between Ireland and the Choctaw Indians of Oklahoma. Mary Robinson, the former president of Ireland, is an honorary Choctaw, and there's plaques acknowledging them everywhere. And that's a rather lovely sculpture that was unveiled last year in Cork, in a town called Middleton, by a guy called Alex Pentek. And it's Choctaw feathers in the shape of a soup bowl, remembering that. Okay, 3 minutes, and then I'll open to a couple of questions. Another unlikely savior of the Irish, Sultan Abdulmajid, of the Ottoman Empire, who had just introduced the Morse, the magnetic telegraph into his kingdom. The first thing he did was to transmit messages to his extensive harem. anyway, if you are a sultan, I suppose. And he contributed £1,200 to the British Association for the Relief of Extreme Distress in Ireland and the Highlands and Islands of Scotland. Catchy name. £1,200 he contributed, which was, after Queen Victoria, was the most that anybody contributed, so extraordinary. He's also credited with sending three ships, Ottoman ships, laden with grain to the Irish port of Drogheda. And I better finish on one, so I'll run with Rodney Baxter, who's a grizzled sea dog from Cape Cod, from the sort of cod hunting community of Hyannis. And he got up, basically a schooner and four other buddies in schooners, and they had a race across the Atlantic Ocean in their schooners with a cargo of corn and other supplies for the Irish. Four of them arrived into Sligo, and one of them arrived around near Belfast. But they had to ride out a storm on it, and Rodney Baggs was such fun that he actually, a bit like somebody from Homer's Odyssey, he has himself strapped to the mast of his ship during the storm with his violin and plays the violin during a really, really vicious storm. No bother on him. On the return journey from Sligo, he completed the journey in 18 days, which was the quickest journey ever taken by a schooner. There are so many stories. Hopefully you've got an idea. It was just fun to stop the clock and to see all the different things and what was the knock-on effects. And, you know, you can explore it far more than I have in this short time. But thank you very much for being a patient audience.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.